Welcome to NorAm Assets, Your Money, with Danny Stewart.
You never know how far the stock is going to go down.
And Tim Razor.
Danny knows I'm a geek for all of this stuff.
If you're seeking the best stock knowledge this side of Wall Street, you've come to the right place.
I'm sorry, did I steal your stuff?
No, you didn't steal any thunder. Who's handling this segment?
For the next hour, Danny and Tim will be talking investing.
Investing is 90% psychological, and I love that.
Trades.
The market will usually overshoot to the downside and to the upside.
And dumpster fires.
When do you say my principal loss isn't worth the dividends I'm getting?
And now, here's your hosts, Danny and Tim.
A day makes, or just a few days, or a week. And by the way, do you know what a BIC or BICE is? It may be very important for your retirement. If things get too topsy-turvy in your retirement accounts and 401ks, and you're asleep at the wheel and don't know what that is, it could have a big effect. And speaking of your retirement, do you know what the income test and resource test is? You better. That could be even more critical for your retirement, but I hope not. Now, before I get into all that, I want to give our stock nerds some red meat right off the bat, give them some gold nuggets before the end of the show where Don Vandenborde is going to, you know, do the good, the bad, the ugly, and everything. Now, the S&P 500 has now had two closes below the 21 exponential moving average and the 50-day simple moving average. The NASDAQ 100, which is what we watch a little more closely than the broader NASDAQ, the NASDAQ 100 is the largest 100 stocks, and the NASDAQ will have also had two closes below the 21 EMA, exponential moving average, but only one close below the 50-day simple moving average. It backs bounced on Friday. Remember, Thursday was a very big sell-off. Now, one day route, everything across the board. Now, the 21 EMA is a shorter term indicator, and the 50-day simple is more of a midterm indicator. So the short-term momentum decidedly turned downward. The question is, will the midterm hold? Now, the point is, risks are elevated at this point, and this could be just a dead cat bounce. Now, you don't have to just run for the hills just yet, but you don't want to go all in, and you want to have a defensive plan ready. Now, we'll get more into that later, stock nerds, and I guess I should introduce the show. Welcome to Your Money Radio. I am your host, Danny Stewart, and on the show, on the bat line, we've got Don.
What the hell's my name?
Don, Almighty Don. It's Don Vandenborde from St. Augustine, Florida. Don, how are you?
I'm great, Dan Stewart. How are you?
It was a Freudian. I just like the name Dan. It's a great name. So,
how many listeners did we lose with your singing at the intro? Do you think?
Oh man, it'll make sense when I say what difference does a day make. I just, you know, one or two days, and that whole market changed character. And you're right. I am a very lousy singer. I should have just like got it on my iPhone and played. You know, piped it in. It's probably what I should have done. You're right.
Is your dancing as bad as your singing?
No, not really. I used to be a really bad dancer. I mean, really, really bad dancer. And now I'm just a bad dancer.
Because as a tennis player, you should have decent footwork.
I've got great footwork, just not on the dance floor, you know.
I see.
Now, because of my beautiful wife, AK, I've gotten better at dancing because she actually grew up. Her mom was a dance teacher, had a dance studio on their ranch, and all the kids in the area, in the county and the little town they grew up in, went and danced from her. Oh, her mom can ballroom, unbelievable. But AK can tap, jazz, ballet. I mean, we go anywhere, and she just melts into the music. Her rhythm is so good, it just makes me sick.
Does she have you doing the boot scoot boogie at home on the hardwood floors?
Actually, that's a pretty easy one to do, but yes, I can, and yes, she does. But she makes the boot scoot boogie look really fancy. You know, you or I, it's just like two little steps and kick up your foot and, you know, kind of whatever.
No, and I don't even know that. That's two more things.
I could teach you the boot scoot boogies. Pretty good. It's like, you know, put your left foot in, put your right foot out. But, you
well,
know,
I could do the hokey pokey.
Yeah, anyway, that's not that much harder than the hokey pokey. I mean, once you do it a couple times, it's an easy. It's kind of like an easy line dance. It's pretty easy. But anyway, I digress. So when I said speaking, do you know what a bic is or a bice? They've now kind of changed the words, Don. I think they're trying to keep us guessing because the bic was the best interest contract. Now, as you know, the Department of Labor rules has been somewhat postponed for a few more months. They're pushing it out to try to figure out what they're going to do. And this is with 401ks, IRAs, you know, things of that nature, all retirement accounts. And you can't really, the new DOL rule is saying you can't do commission products in there, or you can't sell any kind of annuity. You can't do commission products or loaded funds unless you get a best interest contract. Now, the BICE is best interest contract exemption. So they added the E on there. It was always there. But first they were calling them BICs. Now they're just calling them BICE. But the point is, unless you get the client, which is you, listener, to sign something saying, no, you can sell me a commission product. You don't have to act in my best interest. See, up till now, in quote, investment advisors, not us, but investment advisors, not us, but investment advisors used to be able to, or still can, sell. It just had to be suitable. It had to be suitable for you based on you. Well, now it says, regardless of cost, so I could sell you a big 5% loaded mutual fund or even an 8-10% loaded annuity inside an IRA, big mistake, instead of getting you a very similar mutual fund that's almost identical with no load and very low cost. So now they're saying that's not right. You need to put your client's interest first. What a novel idea. We've been doing that since the 90s, and I have not worked on commission since the 90s. Anyway, I digress. The whole point is now they're trying to figure out, you know, you're getting pushback, you're getting lobbyists, you're getting insurance companies, you're getting brokerage firms. Everybody's really fighting this. A lot of companies have already changed course and saw the handwriting on the walls. Now the horse is out of the bag. Everybody's talking about it. So even if they postpone or change the rule, you know, don't enforce it. In other words, don't decide not to follow through with this rule. Everybody's already knows what the deal is. Now they're asking, well, are you selling me a high commission product inside my retirement plan? And if so, why? So you're going to see a lot of changes. And some of the brokerage firms are changing their product lineup. And they're not even, look, when Nationwide announces that they're actually going to do a no-load annuity, you know the times they are changing. So anyway, Don, do you have any thoughts on that? I want to get your thoughts about this DOL.
Yeah, I hadn't heard it referred to as a BIC. I always thought it was a BICE because of the exemption on the end. It was supposed to be something that the advisor would have to get the client to sign to make them exempt from giving you something that might not be in your best interest. Are you saying that by renaming it the BIC, it's something that the advisor instead
signs? No. They're really one and the same. They just throw those terms out interchangeably. Really, the best interest contract really means it's like a contract with the advisor. You got to act in your client's best interest. Otherwise, you can get this bias. You can get the exemption. and you can do it that way. Well, you know, they're actually opposite sides of the same issue. The whole point is, do you now? Here's the argument they're getting, and I know you'll cringe on this, Herr Don. They're saying that, you know, smaller investors won't get serviced. And look, for someone that's going to buy and hold, Don's favorite strategy. I say that with sarcasm for your new listeners. They said they would pay larger amounts over 25 years if they did the advisory fee versus a commission. In other words, if you pay a 5% commission up front and then your mutual fund has very, very low expense ratios, that's better than paying an ongoing management fee if you're simply going to buy and hold. Well, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, we're active managers, Don. If you just want to buy and hold for 25 years, you don't need us. By the way, you don't need any advisor. If you want to buy and hold for 25 years, big mistake. Just call me up. I'll tell you the best way to figure out a pie chart and just sit there. Just be willing to have major drawdowns and lose 30, 40%, 50% of your money every 8 or 10 years or so. And then the problem with that is, will you be able to withstand that pain? What's your uncle point? Because if you sell out near the bottom and then you start over, that's the problem. But so that the main argument is, if you're going to buy and hold, then it should be a commission type structure. Well, okay, I got that. Problem is, now with these robo-tections, these robo-advisors, they're very, very cheap, and they're not commission-based, but it's buy and hold still. You're still going to have to deal with the big drawdowns. Anyway, all the lobbyists on both sides are all fighting over it. Everybody's pulling out the big guns. It's going to be very, very easy. I mean, very, very interesting to see what happens and how this plays out. So anyway, I don't want to beat that to death, because we've talked about the DOL. They have been doing this for a year and a half. And every time I think they're finally going to enact it, and we, Tim and I and you, Don, come out, we start talking about it on the radio, all of a sudden they postpone it or do something different. So anyway, until we really say yes, till the government says yes, we're going to enforce it, yes, we're going to enact it, then I'm not going to get too jazzed up about it. I just want to wait and see what happens. Now, but more importantly, when I said speaking about your retirement, I ask if you know what the income test and resource test was. Don, I'm going to ask you. Do you, Don, know what the income and resource test is?
They're related to Medicaid qualifying.
That's absolutely right. Don, you got a gold star for today. I'm going to put it in the mail tomorrow. So what's really funny is I like how they call it the resource test instead of the asset test. See, Don, you guys like you and me, we call them assets because they're ours. We own them, or the client owns them. They're their assets. To the government, it's a resource. Oh, that's your asset? We want that. You need to give us that. So I just wanted to draw that out. Now, folks, I want to talk about this because this could be very important, you know, for your retirement. And you know, I used to do a whole lot of Medicaid planning. I still do some estate planning for clients and stuff, but I just don't advertise it. I'm actually pretty good at it, very good at it. I just don't like, it's kind of mundane. It's not that much fun. But the bottom line, Don had asked me I got a couple different questions. I got one on Investopedia asking about long-term care insurance, and I'll get to that in a minute. Long-term care, not life insurance, but long-term care insurance. And then when I kind of brought that up, and you were asking me, Don, you were asking me about your mom, for Medicaid or, you know, whatever, coming into some money, whatever. What are the rules on that? Because you didn't know them that well. And so I kind of went and brushed up on them. I actually looked up Florida Texas, I know, because we're here. But because the problem is, it varies state by state, folks. So it changes for every single state. So it's part federal, part state, which really, I mean, now you got to deal with two government entities, right? So I did some research on Florida. I called Don back. He goes, yeah, my mom lives in Pennsylvania. So anyway, herein lies, let me draw the problem first so that you guys, listener land, can start thinking about how you're going to solve the problem. So long-term care, I'm just going to spitball and use round numbers. It doesn't matter whether these ratios are perfectly accurate, these percentages, but they're close enough. So roughly about 50% of the people, slightly more maybe, are going to need long-term care when they get older. Assisted living facilities, in-home health care. If you count in-home health care, it's probably even a little bit higher. Okay? Now, the other half are simply going to pass on. They're going to have a heart attack, stroke, and they won't need it. Now, so I got a letter, and the problem is long-term care, depending on which state you're in. Don, Florida, boy, you guys are expensive. God, you got all the snowboards birds coming from the north, so they kind of bid up the price. The cost of a long-term care in Florida, about anywhere from $7,000 to $8,000 a month.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Really?
Ouch. Well, according to the couple places I looked online, I'm sure you could find them cheaper. Now, in Texas, it's a little over about around $5,000. Okay? Now, I mean, for full board, I mean, look, that's why I hate these averages, because it depends. I mean, we're talking about full board custodial, where you're having someone help you get dressed every day, bathe you, help you take your meds, feed, you know, food. We're talking about living there and taking care of you. You may just, you know, need a little bit of help. So there's different degrees of it. But so this guy, and here's the other problem. So you can either pay out of pocket, in which case, if you've got, I mean, the best alternative is always to self-insure, folks. But if you only got $200,000, $300,000, $500,000, $600,000, and you need long-term care for a long time, I mean, that could significantly affect your spouse. Now, the other thing is, then you could also try to qualify for Medicaid. Medicare doesn't have any kind of long-term care, but little small, you know, benefits for a very short time period. But Medicaid, well, that's for the indigent, the poor, the people that need help. And a lot of Medicaid nursing facilities aren't that good. I mean, they're just, you know, they're not as nice as you might like to stay in. So you really want to shoot a little bit higher. But a lot of people were trying to plan to qualify for Medicaid nursing home assistance from the government. And so they were giving away assets. And I'll get to that in a minute. They were giving away things and doing different things. Don, they changed the rules in like the early 2000s, where they said, you guys help do this Medicaid planning and you teach grandma how to transfer assets. I'm not talking about hiding assets. I'm talking about legitimately transferring assets in certain ways to avoid. In fact, these lawyers running around doing these special Medicaid trusts, which some of them have been outlawed now. They said, you know, you give them advice on how to divest their assets in a certain way, and we're going to go fine you, and you know, it could be even a criminal offense, because we're not going to throw grandma in jail. We're going to come after you. So
they're called resources, Dan, not assets.
Yeah, resource. Yes, if I help grandma take away the resources that she earned,
yes,
her assets.
Wants,
yeah, right,
yes.
Right. Just like the government, whenever a politician, folks, says revenue, it's a way to bring in enhanced revenue. Say, my tax dollars. Anytime they say revenue, that means tax dollars. That's yours and mine, just to clarify. Now, so the problem with so, you know, you got a dilemma here. Number one, the cost of long-term care insurance the cost of long-term care itself has gotten so out of hand that it's very difficult to figure out. And a lot of these people worked hard all their lives, and they want to leave something to their spouse or especially their kids, and it may just run them out of money. So there's kind of an ethical dilemma. Do you give away all your assets before you get government assistance? I mean, where is the line? Where do you draw the line where it should be helped? And so a lot of these states have different rules and different levels of aid, and they're trying to figure this out. Now, so the big question is long-term care insurance versus Medicaid. And what is your choice to be? And by the way, I can't give you 100% advice without jeopardizing myself with regard to Medicaid. That's, you know, penalties and fines, oh my. So if your
assets are gone, there is no Medicare.
It's a Medicaid. If your assets are gone, it's yes.
If your assets are gone, it's Medicaid.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's just big picture, because you could really dive in the minutia, and it gets really, really hard to figure out. You really need to go to someone like me or someone that really, or even a Medicaid expert that only does Medicaid. I mean, I can point you in the right direction. I can do the research myself for a fee, but I used to do this all the time, and I used to know all these numbers in the back of my head. They change every year. But the bottom line is, so the idea for Medicaid is that there's a revenue an income test. If your income's too high, you don't qualify. You can't get Medicaid, you know, for the nursing home. That means you just pay your own way. Okay? Now, don't confuse that with your income, because if your income's low enough that you qualify, and I'll get to that in a minute, that just qualifies you and they'll kick in and the state will start paying. But they still expect you to give up your income that you are getting. So say you're under the thing, you're getting $1,500 a month, so you're under the Medicaid threshold, you qualify. They still expect you to give up all that $1,500 a month, except you can keep $60 for incidentals, for what do they call it? Miscellaneous requirements. So they'll let you keep a little bit. Okay,
$2 a day.
Well, it may be. Let me look. Okay, so here is the resource test for a single person. So that's assets to you and me, but it's resources to the government. What do you think that is, Don?
How
much can you have left? So if you got 100 grand, you saved up, worked hard all your life, you're getting up there in years, your wife, your spouse predeceased you, and you want to leave a little to your kids, and all of a sudden you need long-term care at $5,000 a month.
I'm going to say $10,000 a kid.
No. So you will not qualify for Medicaid until you have less than $2,000. That's for the indigent. Now,
wow.
It's if for a couple who both need Medicare, it's $3,000. Now, so basically, if you're both in the nursing home or both need big time care, you got to spend all your stuff down. Now, there are a couple things that don't count toward this, and a couple of them are kind of ridiculous, I think. But okay, so in Texas, the house you live in is excluded up to $560,000 of equity. So you got a nice house, you can keep that. You basically tell them you have the intent on moving back. You have the intent of living there, or your spouse at some point, you or your spouse. So 560 of equity is exempt. You know, that's kind of reasonable. That's upper middle class or middle class, especially with the prices of real estate now. One vehicle, regardless of value. So go buy a $2 million Ferrari. See, that's the one to me that is kind of ridiculous. Because you could go buy a collector car for $2 million to protect it, right? A life insurance policy, no more than $1,500 of cash value, and a burial plot. So that is if you both need to go into the care, right? Now, if one of the spouses is dead or you're single and you go in, they're not going to make you sell the house. They're going to tell you you as long as you have the intent of moving back in. Okay, now the income limits for a couple or for one patient is around $2,200 to qualify. So if you're getting more than $2,200 a month, Don, you can't qualify for Medicaid, even though it may cost $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000. If you're getting $2,200 and so in all your income, then you don't qualify. Now, even if you qualify, the nursing home is going to take almost all that money except the $60 per month for incidental items. Okay? For a couple, it's $4,400. Okay? Now, like I told you, the countable assets are $2,000. Here's where it gets a little bit fishy. I mean, a little bit tougher to figure out. There is a range, a minimum and a maximum, when you've got a spouse that's out of the nursing home. So when you got one spouse that needs care, they're going to say, well, we're not going to take you down to the resources of $3,000 like I talked about earlier, because one spouse is still functioning, living at home, and she needs some money or he needs some money. So there's a range between $24,900 actually. So you can keep up to $120,000 for a spouse if one of them goes into the nursing home for Medicaid. The other one can stay out, okay? Because they need that money to live on. Well, if they live 20 years, that's really not a whole lot of money. So the whole point is, and here's the problem. So Medicaid, once you qualify for Medicaid, they bring you in, they run you all out of your money. Or if you don't qualify just yet, you got to spend down your assets till you are indigent, and then you qualify for Medicaid. And then they cost shift, and they start getting somebody else. So that is one scenario. You either pay out of pocket $4,000 or $5,000 a month, could be more, depending on the state, or you are indigent and you qualify for Medicaid. Now, remember, Medicaid nursing homes are not the best nursing homes. I mean, my goal would be to try to qualify for a nursing home that didn't take Medicaid patients, okay, and pay out of pocket or have insurance. Now, so this is where this whole discussion started. Folks, I know this is a little bit bland, but it's very, very important. Now, this guy sent me an email, and he said, my wife and I have long-term care insurance, but we just received a second significant rate increase. We are both 67 years old. I have transitioned from full employment to working part-time. Should we consider getting rid of the long-term care insurance? Should there be a stronger consideration for this after I retire and our finances become very tight? So I basically said, look, at the end of the day, it becomes a value judgment. It might, but here are the very important factors you need to consider. It, like I said before, it's always better to self-insure. If you don't need the insurance, then you want to self-insure, because again, half the time or 40% of the time, you may just keel over. If you get long-term care insurance and you're paying big premiums, you know, $10,000, $15,000 a year, and then you never need it, it's gone. You'll never see that money back. So that's the problem I have with it. Now, the other thing is they get to do the underwriting like life insurance. And for long-term care insurance, they're going to take your blood and urine. They're going to look at your family genes. They're going to look at your heredity. They're going to look at your grandmother, your great-grand. I mean, they're going to look through your family history, because they don't want people that get sick, have a history of mental health issues or you know, needing long-term care. They want to get healthy people that can be paying premiums for a long time. Okay. Now, the other thing is you got to make sure custodial care is covered, because a lot of them just bathing and helping getting dressed rather than medically necessary needs. Necessary needs are always covered under almost every policy, but custodial care, even there'll be some policies that allude to the fact it looks like it's covered, but then in the fine print back in the last pages, it's not covered. So that's why if you see a much cheaper policy, I can almost guarantee you custodial care is not covered. You need to look at it. Now, here is the kicker, and here's what people don't realize. And this is the most important. Insurance companies are allowed to raise their prices by group. They can't discriminate. They can't say, you, Bob, you're starting to come up with some we're gonna kick you out for you. We're going to raise your price. But they can raise the actual group based on, quote, actual experience. As their actual costs start coming in, what they're actually experiencing, that's an insurance term, their actual experience, then they can raise the whole group to help cover the cost. So that's why you see what they'll do is they'll create an insurance policy for about 2 years, 3 years. And then they'll come up with a slightly different policy. It's almost the same, but it's version two. And they start underwriting for that group because that's a different policy. Different policy, different group. So now you're 10, 15, 20 years. Because remember, for the first 10 years, 15 years, they're collecting premiums real nice because they've done the underwriting. They know how healthy you are. They're not going to give it to you if you're pretty sick already. As claims start coming in, they start raising the price on the entire group. So don't expect that your premium is going to remain the same through your lifetime. It's not like a term policy, a 30-year term, okay? In fact, eventually they will price out quite a few people in that policy. In fact, it has a self-fulfilling prophecy. As more people drop out and less premiums are being paid, they keep raising the price on the groups. So a lot of people who think, ooh, this is kind of reasonable and it covers custodial care, you need to factor in about a 20% hike, maybe even a 25 or 30% hike in the cost of those premiums over the next 15 or 20 years. And you all, because you need to, you know, when they first started getting their first claims, that's the people that will benefit. Because once you start making, you know, claims needing the health care, they, you know, you don't keep paying premiums. It stops. So if you are not one of the first percentage, the first group sick, you may get priced out. So you think you'll have that long-term policy, but you may not. Now, while I'm not, and the other thing is you may just die and not need the premiums. That's the problem with long-term care. So if you're going to do long-term care insurance, then number one, look at a premium rider, like a rider, see how much it is to pay a little bit more up front to have a no increase in cost rider. You can get those. And make sure custodial cost is covered. Now, while I'm not a big fan of life insurance, except to insure a risk, so normally I like term policies. There are dual life insurance policies that can cover a certain amount of long-term care needs or a death benefit. So I'm just throwing out round numbers. This is not any particular person. Say you're 60 and you think, okay, I'm worried about this, or 55, I'm worried about this long-term care. You're not really trying to look for a death benefit. You're looking more at the long-term care benefit. That's what you care about. So you may, and it's usually a lump sum policy, you may be able to pay $50,000 or $75,000 lump sum that gets a small interest rate, a guaranteed interest rate, like a universal life policy, that is a death benefit, say $250 or $200, okay? But it has a long-term care benefit that might be $350. It may not be the same as a death benefit, but it can be paid out in monthly, it is paid out in monthly increments. Now, they do the underwriting. It's still expensive, and it's still insurance. I still don't like it. But at least someone, your heirs or you, will receive some benefit at some point. Because with a long-term care insurance, if you simply die, the insurance goes away. I mean, the premiums you lost, they went out the door. Here, you've got a lump sum, you put the money in, so you say you count that as your safe cash value CD-like account, and you may be able, and so if you just die and you don't need the long-term care insurance, then you... You can use your kids get the death benefit. If you need the care, then it'll pay out some defined benefit like $4,000 a month. It pays out a monthly benefit up to that amount and then stops. Now I use the $350 amount. Say you only did $100,000 and then you died. Well, then the difference between that and the death benefit your heirs would get. So you're going to get some combination of the monies back. It's still insurance, still costs money. There's still premiums to be paid. But that's another option. It's not the best option. And by the way, Don, the thing that I was telling you about earlier with the Medicaid, is the look back. So if you teach people, remember, if you got the assets, government calls them resources, if we actually try to take away, if we try to give away our assets, because you know you don't have to die to give your assets to your kids. You can give them to them now. Problem is you don't know if they'll give them back to you when you want them, when you need them. You worked hard all your life for that, for those assets. And so you would have given to them a long time ago if you'd wanted. But say I gave away assets, there's what's called a look back test. So they're going to, Don, they're going to look back and they're going to say, they're going to look and see, and they will look back. I think it's $5,000 a month. So the bottom line is, say you gave back, say you gave to your kids $50,000, right? Or $75,000. At $75,000, you wouldn't qualify for 60 months. Okay? So that's one reason you can't get around that. And that's what they were talking about with the advisors. They were saying, look, you guys can't go tell the grandma to go start giving away her assets to all her kids, and then they can slide it back to her under the table, because, you know, then and we can't get to it because then Medicaid will be indigent. So they look back for 5 years based on like a fourth, I think it's $4,000 a month benefit. That's how you get that 5 years. It used to be only 3 years. Now it's 5 years. So that is a very hard question. And look, guys, I know this is mundane, but this is one of the biggest challenges with retirement planning. It's very easy to figure out when you're going to run out of money, how much you need to save, how much you, what you need to do. The biggest wild card, the biggest unknown, is healthcare cost and your longevity. If you can tell me when you're going to die, the day you're going to die, I can tell you exactly what to do. I can tell you which choice to make, which is the best option. Don't know that. So anyway, I digress. I know that was kind of down a rabbit hole. I know that was boring, Don, but I thought that was important to hit, especially when you brought it up. When I started asking you some questions about it and you brought it up about your mother, I figured, you know what, if it's coming up, if it's on your mind, it must be on other people's minds too.
It is, and it's, you know, that it's the, really the second of the great unknown, well, three unknowns, but as you get older. One, how healthy are you going to be? Two, how long are you going to live? And three, how much is it going to cost to keep you alive while you're alive?
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, look, my dad, he, you know, honestly, he's not in great health right now. He's getting up there. He's about 85 and he has some health issues, and he was a very, very good doctor, self-made man, worked his way through medical school. Just loved him to death. Very proud of him. He told me once, you know, because everybody was arguing about America's not the greatest medical, you know, place on the earth and everything. And I asked him, and I was probably 20 years ago. And I was probably 37, whatever, 30, well, I'm 53 now. But anyway, so I asked him, I said, Dad, what do you think about our medical system? He goes, best damn system in the world, bar none. I said, well, what do you think? They talk about Europe and they talk about, and he says, If every place is so good, how come all the best and brightest students come to America to go to medical school? They don't go down to the islands. They don't go to Europe. They come here for medical school. That's where they
don't go to Cuba.
They actually, Fidel Castro comes here, secret plane. Anyway, but so he said, you know, the problem in our country, son, I hate to say this, he said, but our medicine has gotten so good, we can actually keep people alive longer than the quality of life.
Yep.
And that's a tough ethical, moral question. So what do you do? I don't have the answer to that. I absolutely don't. But anyway, somehow you need to figure out for you and your own family what the answer is going to be. Certainly, if you don't have wills and durable health powers, get those in order right away. That's very important. All right, we'll get off that topic. If you got any questions or comments on that, you want more information, you can certainly reach out to me. Now for just a few little fun facts. I ran across this article on ThinkAdvisor, Don, and did you know that advisors are getting younger? So basically,
I did not know that.
Yeah. So basically what they're saying is the financial advice industry.
Wait, I'm an advisor. Are you saying I'm getting younger?
No, you're getting older and more mature. I'm saying, here's the bottom line. Here's the takeaway. A lot of these big, large financial institutions, brokerage firms, investment banks, they're getting rid of their older, experienced advisors that have seen five bear markets, and they're hiring young advisors that maybe, if they're lucky, have seen 2008, probably never saw 2000. And the reason they're doing that is so that they can pay them less. They make less fees. So it may not be.
No.
It may not be about your retirement. It may be about their bottom line and profitability. So anyway, they can also probably mold them better and kind of get them to do what they want. Because you guys like you and me, we're kind of stubborn. And we can kind of see through the BS, and we kind of know when they're trying to have us push to sell a package product, annuity, that we are not going to bite and do that. In fact, that's why I left in the 90s and got rid of the shackles and the chains. And I think a lot of older advisors, middle-aged and older advisors that, have some clients, they're doing that. They're leaving these big brokerage firms because they're kind of getting tired of it. All right. One other thing before we go to break, and then Stock Nerds, I promise you we will get down and dirty. It will be everything markets. We will give you your fill. Germany and France are playing hardball. They're planning an all-out assault on Ireland. More specific, no, it's not with tanks. It's not with guns. They're not going to go bomb Ireland. But they're seriously saying, we need to have one unified corporate tax. Ireland has one of the lowest corporate tax rates in the world. They're stealing business, not only from America, but from the EU. The EU does not like it. They want a one higher corp, because they got to pay their bonds off. They borrowed so much money, they got to figure out how to get out of it. And so they are trying to figure out how to get out of this dilemma, but they are threatening Ireland to kick Ireland out of the European Union. They said, if you don't play ball with us and raise your tax rates, we're going to have a serious discussion. So I thought that very interesting. Oh, I forgot. I know what I was going to talk about very quickly. I'm getting older, forgetful. Maybe I need long-term care. I was talking about what a difference a day makes. Well, folks, in the markets this week, we had a significant change in character, especially on Thursday. On Thursday, you saw a major sell-off in the markets. Now, before that, everything was fine. Before that, everybody was talking about low volatility, that a week ago, bond yields, TLT actually spiked in yield, and prices went down because they were worried about wage inflation and all that kind of stuff. And stocks were doing swim. Everything was fine. And everybody was talking about the low volatility.
That was after the jobs report.
Exactly. And you know who my favorite guy is? He was right again. Gundlach came out and said, he did. Between you and me, I heard he's very arrogant, I won't say it on air, but very tough guy to deal with. Let's put it that way. But the guy is extremely sharp, and he looks at the big picture. He's got a bunch of experts in his office. It's a real good expert on one specific genre or niche, and he listens to them, takes what they've got, and kind of puts a mosaic theory and puts it all together, and he's right. When volatility hit 9 and change, and it was at historical lows, he looked around and said, this can't last forever, and, some of these people can get burned. Betting that volatility is going to go up, that seems like it'd be free money. Well, that trade's probably up easily 20% or more in just 3 or 4 days. So he said this like Monday, like a week ago. But anyway, the whole point is, what a difference a day makes. So Thursday, we had a significant change in character. TLT prices went up. In fact, I think, Don, you can correct me, I think TLT, meaning the long-term treasury bonds, hit a high last week, a mid or short-term high in price, and yields came down, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, conversely...
Gave it all back this week, though.
Right, right. Conversely... But you're saying, well, let's back up. You're saying that this week TLT went up, right, in price.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, but high yield bonds, junk bonds, got crushed and their price went down, meaning their yields went up. So the difference between government bonds and junk bonds has widened significantly. In fact, that's another risk measure. It's like the sort of like the volatility index. A lot of people use that too. So you can watch the price and volatility. Now, the way to really make decent money on that, if you're a trader, not a trader like Benedict Arnold, but a stock trader.
I think they knew what you meant.
I just wanted to clarify that. You never know who's listening. I get into history sometimes. I go anywhere. It doesn't matter. When you think that fear, that spread has maxed out, has gotten very real wide, and you think the fear is about to subside, the Korean thing's going to go away, or it's overblown, then you can actually buy the high yield bonds and let it correct or come down. I mean, you can go up in price, yield come down. So it can bid up the price. But the whole point is, just a week ago, volatility was at lows. They were talking about how, you know, it's been low for a long time. It's not going to go up for a long time. And all of a sudden, and that's complacency, on Thursday, all the big names, Amazon, Microsoft, even the biotechs, even good, strong biotechs, big like brand names like Johnson & Johnson, they all got taken to the woodshed. So did REITs. Here's the other thing. The advancing versus declining volumes in equities is starting to change character, where you're getting a more declining volume than you are advancing volume. So you're seeing some things under the hood that were warning signs. We'll talk more about that on the other side of the break on Your Money.
Hi, I'm Sam Jackson. Cancer will strike more than 175,000 kids worldwide this year alone. This includes infants, children, teens, and young adults. The likelihood that teens and young adults will survive cancer is far greater when treated by pediatric oncologists. Survival can depend on treatment from experts in childhood cancer and a commitment to collaborative, groundbreaking research. To learn more, go to stbaldrick's.org or standuptocancer.org.
And welcome back to Your Money Radio, folks. I'm your host, Danny Stewart, and on the bat line, we got Don Vandenborn from St. Augustine, Florida, portfolio extraordinaire. And Don, I was just talking about the significant change in character from just early last week, Monday and Tuesday. Everybody's talking about how low volatility is. In fact, it hit historical lows. I talked about how TLT, the yields on treasuries, was actually spiking and prices was coming down. And on Thursday, with that big sell-off, that Korean scare, whatever you want to call it, TLT prices, long-term treasury prices, reversed and hit a high. And high-yield bonds, junk bonds, more risky bonds, they got crushed. Their price came down and their yields went up. The spread widened. Also, volatility had a huge spike. And as I said in the very beginning of the first segment, I gave the gold nugget to the stock nerds that listened to the very first beginning of the show. We're throwing out a gold nugget at the beginning of every show. I told you that the S&P 500 closed below the 21 exponential moving average both Thursday and Friday, and the 50-day. So both the short-term and the midterm indicator. Now, the NASDAQ 100, the biggest NASDAQ stocks, they closed below the 21 EMA 2 days in a row, which is, can signify a change in trend, but did manage to retake the 50-day on Friday. So the 21 exponential moving average is a shorter-term indicator. The 50-day is more of a is a midterm indicator. So it means short-term momentum was weaker and down, especially on the NASDAQ, more than the midterm indicator. The whole point is you don't have to rush for the exits just yet, but you definitely ought to be paying attention and your antenna ought to be up. So with Don, I want to get your thoughts on the markets, and we can even do the good, the bad, the ugly. You can drive now. It's your turn.
The only index left standing above the 21, Dan, is the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and I've been saying for a while that it's a mild cause for concern when you're seeing significant outperformance by the Dow, because it is a flight to safety. And that really came to fruition on Thursday. We started to break down on Wednesday, but there was a nice stick save, I guess you could say, goal line stand at the 21-day moving average.
Toward the end of the day, right?
Yeah, for the S&P 500. This was after Tuesday making a new high. I mean, Tuesday there was some euphoria in the market. We had a little bit of a gap up, and things looked great, frankly. And then a negative reversal about halfway through the day followed through to Thursday. But as we've seen so many times before, buyers came in at the 21 EMA, and that broke down along with some the North Korea comments. You know, sometimes the markets just look for an excuse.
Right.
So I don't really know if it, obviously when you've got Captain Crazy Pants talking about nuclear missiles at Guam, there's going to put some fear into the market, but for a long time I've been talking about how the VIX just keeps going down, down, down. And it was the revenge of the VIX this week, without a doubt. So, you know, you segued kind of into the ugly, which is the short volatility trade, which had been so rewarding all throughout 2017. The VXX up 22%, the XIV, which is short volatility, down 20% for the week. So definitely an elevator down situation after climbing the escalator up on the short volatility trade. That was definitely the ugly for the week. The bad is really anybody owning stocks. 9 of the 10 broad spider sectors were down for the week. Only consumer staples, XLP, managed a meager plus 0.3% gain for the week. And all 6 of the big indexes, which is the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, the Dow, the mid-cap, and the 2 small-cap indexes, that's 7 actually, all 7 of them, took it on the chin for the week. The Dow, the strongest, down 1%, and the small caps, the weakest, down 0.8 and 2.6. And in fact, one of the small cap indexes, the small cap 600, broke the 200-day moving average also. Two closes below the 200 now for the small cap 600. The Russell 2000 finished right above the 200-day moving average. And, you know, you mentioned the 21 as our short term and the 50 as our intermediate term. This is the first close below in over a year on any of the major indexes below the 200-day moving average, which we use for the long term.
Right, right. No, so let me just recap. You can get into some very specifics in a minute, but let me just recap. So, folks, what Don's saying is, And I want to make sure this doesn't pass over, gloss over. The flight to quality is on. At least it was Thursday and even on Friday, even though we got a bounce. The large cap stocks, the Dow was the strongest. And then as you went down in both market cap and riskier sectors, meaning by volatility, like the bio caps, the biotechs, the, you know, technology, that kind of stuff, sold off more. So as you go down, so the small caps are the weakest of the layer, small, mid, large cap. And it's not just in stocks, folks. The bonds, are the same way. It was a flight to treasuries and away from everything else with the exception of investment grade bonds and treasuries. So again, we may get a very strong bounce on Monday. Who knows? But right now, it remains to be seen. It looks like this could be a change in character. Now, the way that we handle this, we've already raised quite a bit of cash. What would you say, down 20, 25%?
30.
Okay. So if that we can go back in if it gets all of a sudden look strong again. But if it continues to sell off, we can start raising even more cash. You don't want to make huge swings where you go 50, 70% out, 50, 70% back in because you get whipsawed too much. But you do have to manage risk because, look, I don't mind. It doesn't matter. As long as I'm right around kind of where the market is when it's trending higher, I'm fine with that. I just don't want to give it all back when it goes down. I don't want to be in line with the market when it sells off. Now, I'm okay selling out three or four times to miss the next big double-digit correction. I don't know which one that's going to be. I don't know if it's going to be the first one or the fourth one. I do know that if I go, oh, this one's probably not it. This is probably fine. It'll probably come back this time. That's going to be the one that it does it. So I'm willing to put up with getting whipsawed once or twice and giving up 1% or 2% versus the S&P a couple of times because I know, and in a good market, because we're buying some stocks that are a little bit higher beta stocks than the S&P, we'll catch up and do fine. I'm not worried about that. What I want to do is I don't want to go down with the market in a big sell-off. When I miss two-thirds or even 75% of the next big sell-off, I will be sitting like roses to get back in for the next strong, strong uptrend. That's when that's basically when we make our management, earn our management fees for a decade. That's the time. Now, this may not be it. I just want to watch the tea leaves. I want to watch the charts. That's why I got Don and Tim both. Because emotionally, it feels like that. Because I get emotional too. It's hard. I'm looking and I'm going, you know what? This thing could get ugly. So it feels like Friday was a kind of dead cat bounce, a bounce into resistance. I could be wrong on that. I've got to be at peace with the market could go up or the market could go down. But right now, my antenna are very up, erect. Now, Don, I want to throw that to you. With that said, Friday, did that? What do you think about that? Does that look like it was a dead cat bounce? Did it look like it's a weak bounce? Or did that make you, did you see the market in a more bullish light after Friday?
No, I see it as a weak bounce. There are a lot of things that are oversold. Oversold can get worked off by two things. One is price and the other is time. So you need to look at a combination of the two of them to see if you're objectively going to form a bottom. But as of right now, and one of the key things that we're going to be looking at next week is whether or not this bounce is just coming up into resistance and then it's going to fail and roll over again. And the four key things that I'm going to look for, I've been mentioning these this week in the videos. The three keys that I said on Monday were small caps, the stocks, and the transports. I needed to see the small caps get back above the 50-day moving average. Well, that certainly didn't happen. They struggled the first part of the week, even while the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ were holding up. The second was the SOX, the semiconductor index. I wanted that to hold the 50-day moving average, and that didn't. That failed on Thursday. And the third was I wanted transports to hold the 200-day moving average, and they've done that so far. And that's one of the keys that I'm going to be watching for next week to see if they can continue to do that or if all they're forming is a bear flag and they're going to go lower. But I want to add a fourth into that, Dan, because I'm really surprised at how weak the banks were this week. KBE, that's really the big bank index, down 4.5%. That really got taken to the woodshed. And the financials, XLF, was the worst of the 10 spider sectors, down 2.7%. I think that's really got to be concerning. I know it goes a little bit hand in hand with what was going on with the interest rates, but this seemed like an outsized move down in the banks compared to what interest rates did.
Right, right. No, I would definitely agree with that. All right, so do you have any stocks that you are really bird-dogging right now that you're following?
Well, I'll talk about the conversations that you and I and Tim had this morning before the open. I was really looking to see what NVIDIA was going to do. From all reports, it had a great quarter, up 124% on sales. On earnings, up 56% on revenues. And the stock for the day ended up dropping 5.3%. So it opened right about its 50-day moving average. I was looking for a positive sign to be buyers coming in right at that 50-day moving average. And that lasted about an hour before it headed lower, finished about mid-range. But I think that NVIDIA is really one of the keys to the market. When you've got a big leading stock that's putting up a great earnings report and it gets smacked down, that's telling you something.
That means sentiment has changed. Market sentiment
is changing. Yeah. People are taking profits instead of buying. All stocks consolidate sometimes. Sometimes they consolidate with the market. Sometimes they consolidate without the market. If the market's going to be weak, you're going to see 75% of all stocks consolidate and form bases and take upon the direction of the market. But then you'll see that 25% that are going to buck the trend. And you saw that a little bit this week with the strength in gold, GDX, SLV.
It's TLT, a fear trade for sure.
And XLP, the staples. Right. So it's absolutely the fear trade. That was the only good that came out of the market this week. I mentioned the ugly and the bad. That was the only good.
Now, by the way, in full disclosure, we actually sold NVIDIA on Wednesday or Tuesday. I think Wednesday.
We sold it before earnings Thursday. Yeah, right. In fact, I said in the video, Tim and I were talking about it Wednesday afternoon, and especially after the bounce off the 21-day moving average, I said, now we've got earnings tomorrow. What do you think about NVIDIA? And we both agreed that really at that point there was no reason to sell it. He took a look at what the implied volatility was and the position size that we had, and it seemed fine, but that certainly came off the table after the reaction
of the total market
Thursday. There's always more things to consider than just the stock itself. You got to consider the sector. You got to consider the overall market also.
Right.
And the fact that a lot of good earnings reports just frankly got sold off. Facebook's one of the few that had a gap up and really just has gone sideways. Apple also. Actually, Apple is right near the low of the gap of the first day, but it sold off pretty hard on Thursday too. Right. And we know what's happened to Amazon and Google. So there's a lot to watch for right now. It's always good to have. We haven't had a significant correction in a while. It's good to have them. I mean, we had 16 straight days, Dan, where we closed between 2470 and 2480. Right. On the S&P 500, something big is coming after that. And I'm fond of saying from failed moves come fast moves in the opposite direction. I didn't think we got that with the stick save on Wednesday, but Thursday, certainly we broke down quickly after the false breakout earlier in the week.
Absolutely. Well, folks, we are actually going to be there Monday morning early, ready to go, watching the indices. Don, what's going to be your top one or two things you're going to key on before the open on Monday?
I'm going to keep an eye on those four sectors: small caps, banks, semiconductors, and transports. And I again want to see if NVIDIA really has been the newest of the new merchandise in this new rally, and is it really time to say it's time to base and move on to other things and take it off the watch list, or is it something to keep an eye on? Another thing I want to keep an eye on is there's been a lot of strength in China stocks lately.
Right.
There were some rumblings Thursday night about China regulators that took a couple of them down. We've owned Baba for a while. It's got earnings coming up next week. It had a very nice comeback from an early sell-off on Friday. That's something I'm going to be keeping a close eye on.
Okay.
Finished at the top of its range, right at the 21, bounced off the 50. It's the performance that you want to see in a leader. Whether or not that continues will remain to be seen next week.
All right, Don, thanks a lot. Well, Stock Nerds, how was that for some red meat, baby? All right, if you like what you heard, tell a friend, tell a neighbor. And if you want to check out more of our work, just go to revereasset.com. Again, that's revereasset.com. And you can email me at dan@revereasset.com, don@revereasset.com, and tim@revereasset.com. We made it real easy for you. Or you can call us old school at 855-REAL-WEALTH. We'll talk to you next week on Your Money.